From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. The government of Nepal says it needs almost $7 billion to repair earthquake damage in the country. Nearly 8,000 people died when three big quakes shattered the Himalayan nation in April and again in May. Half of the homes were destroyed. In 10 days, governments from around the world will attend a special conference to pledge support and for a reconstruction effort. Michael Rapper is from the Australian Red Cross and has just returned from Nepal, where the monsoons are settling in. Peter Lloyd began by asking him how that is affecting conditions on the ground.
It means that the difficulties they were already confronting are now being compounded by the fact that a lot of fissures, a lot of cracks all route through the mountains, all around even Kathmandu, and the water is seeping into those, and they're now suffering landslides as well.
Right, so it's not just discomfort, it's actual danger.
Oh, it's real danger. There are still aftershocks almost every day. There have been 300 so far. It's worth remembering that that earthquake was 7.9 on the Richter scale on Anzac Day, another one 6.9 next day, and then another 7.4 on 12th of May. 8,600 people died. About 20,000 people were injured, and at least 3.2 million displaced. That means not able to occupy their households. The immediate response means you have to get tarpaulins out to people, you have to get hygiene kits, their water supplies are interrupted, they've got no food, they've got no tools to help even clear the rubble, let alone rebuild. But now it's time to shift into the most important recovery phase, the longer term recovery, which we think is going to take 3 to 5 years at least.
And when we talk about recovery, are we talking about major construction, major infrastructure? What are the big-ticket items that the Nepalese really need?
The biggest ticket item is shelter. 3.2 million people displaced. Over 650,000 houses are gone, right? And we think that, or the government of Nepal, National Planning Commission, has estimated that need to be about $3.3 billion just alone. But the most immediate is the housing, the shelter, restoration of that, and getting back into semi-permanent or more durable shelter to get through the monsoons and to get through the winter, which will be soon upon us, and it's pretty severe, as you know, in Nepal.
We often hear the expression, build it back better after major disasters, especially Aceh. Is that the kind of guiding philosophy of the Nepalese? Are they looking to build back something better than what was there before?
Absolutely. Every lesson that we've learned from all of the disasters around the world is you take the opportunity to build back better. But, you know, many of these people out in remote areas, they're going to build themselves. They're not going to wait. They can't wait. So giving them some cash transfers, a little bit of money to get them through the next couple of months, their livelihood, giving them some tools, and this is where it comes to not just the hardware side of recovery, but the software side. One of the things we specialise in is that software side, the training, the assistance to people, the community-based training, awareness raising, teaching them how to rebuild, how to build back better, so they don't just put back the little shelter that's going to fall down again next time.
Now, on the bigger picture, the government of Nepal said at the weekend that looking like needing $6.6 billion over 5 years, it's a mind-blowingly, staggeringly large amount of money. Is that sort of money achievable, given the exhaustion of the world community in recent years in the donation sphere?
It's true that the government's planning commission has estimated the damage, the cost being about $6.6 billion to repair it, but the World Bank estimates that it could be $1 to $2 billion at least short. And that's, of course, a massive tragedy because I've seen the damage. You know, people are not exaggerating. It is really severe. So I hope that when the governments of the world come together in Nepal in 2 weeks' time, they do bring their checkbooks, they do open their hearts and put their hands, their hearts and their head together to make sure that this is something that we address immediately.
And if listeners want to contribute, if they want to make their contribution, how do they do that?
Our appeal is still open. Just go to the Red Cross website, obviously, you know, www.redcross.org.au, and we'd be more than happy to round up some more money.
Michael Rapper from the Australian Red Cross speaking to Peter Lloyd. South Korea's health ministry has reported 5 new cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, and it's taking the total number of cases to 105 and the number of deaths to 16. The outbreak is the largest outside Saudi Arabia and has forced the closure of a prestigious hospital. Christine Kearney reports.
South Korean health officials have confirmed two more deaths from the deadly virus in the past 12 hours. One was a 62-year-old man who died in the city of Busan. He'd contracted the disease after visiting the Samsung Medical Center in Seoul, where more than 70 people are being treated for the virus. The center has now suspended most of its services after being identified as the source of almost half the cases in the South Korean outbreak. Hospital President Song Jae-hoon says it stopped admitting new patients and doing surgery not considered urgent.
메르스 총력 대응을 위하여 부분적으로 병원을 폐쇄하겠습니다.
We will partially close the hospital in order to fully focus on counteracting MERS. Other than emergency operations, we are also going to temporarily set a restriction on outpatient treatments, hospitalization, as well as operations and treatments on emergency patients. Also, we will limit the visitors coming in to visit inpatients.
Among the confirmed cases is an emergency ward assistant who worked for days after developing symptoms. Song Jae-hoon issued a public apology for being at the epicentre of the spread of the disease, for which there's no cure or vaccine and is fatal in about a third of cases.
I apologise for the Samsung Medical Center becoming the epicentre of the epidemic of MERS, and additionally, I'm sorry to have caused you so much anxiety due to patient number 137, the emergency room transfer agent.
A total of two doctors and three nurses from the hospital are confirmed as infected, with some 400 patients, families and medical staff under quarantine. Nearly 5,000 people possibly exposed to the virus are under observation nationwide. But almost all confirmed cases were infected in hospitals, and so far there's little sign of general spread within the population. That hasn't stopped South Koreans staying away from public places like sporting events and shopping centres, affecting shopkeepers like this candle seller.
There was a 70% drop in sales last week and 90% drop this week. It's really hard for me to run the store because the number of foreigners and also local customers have decreased. I hope the MERS situation will be resolved soon.
Meanwhile, officials in Slovakia say they're hopeful a South Korean man being tested for the virus would not become Europe's first case. And in Hong Kong, experts were also hopeful the disease would not spread. Chair Professor Malik Pyrus of the University of Hong Kong.
It is too early to say whether this is going to be a sustained effect or not. So the next week will be very crucial. Given that situation, I think if things go well, the risk of this spilling out of Korea in any significant way is small.
The World Health Organization will be holding an emergency meeting tomorrow for what it's called a large and complex outbreak.
More details are emerging about the latest turnback of asylum seekers to Indonesia. A document given to ABC Radio by Indonesian police provides new details about how Australian authorities allegedly intercepted an asylum seeker boat, transferred the passengers onto two boats, and sent them back to Indonesia. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says he's been told of a group of at least 65 asylum seekers that he saw Australia hand back with a thick envelope to the captain of their vessel before the boat was turned around. Michael Brissenden speaks to our correspondent in Indonesia, George Roberts.
George Roberts, what have the Indonesian police shown you? What evidence have they shown you?
Well, the spokesman for Indonesian police here in West Timor, or East Nusa Tenggara, as it's known in Indonesia, has given us a document, an internal police document, which is a presentation of their initial findings from their investigation into the alleged turn back by Australian authorities and also into the allegations that Australian authorities paid more than $30,000 to the crew of the boat in order to return the asylum seekers back to Indonesia. And what this document does, and they've backed it up with some photographs of the wads of cash that were allegedly provided by the Australian authorities and the two boats that were allegedly provided by Australian authorities. And these documents map out the whole trip right back from the recruitment by people smugglers of the crew of the boats back in April, the pickup of the passengers off West Java, and then their journey to the waters off East Timor, where they were allegedly first intercepted by Australian authorities.
And what actually happened on the water? Because there are reports that the Australians actually intervened and told them that their boat was unseaworthy and then turned them back.
According to this document, they were intercepted twice. They were intercepted once by a customs ship, and they were given a warning that they were not allowed to enter Australian waters, or enter Australia actually, without appropriate visas. They were given or shown warning cards, which is a fairly standard procedure where there are cards that are handed out to the passengers and crews of boats in the various languages that the people on board speak, that tell them that, you know, this is the Australian policy and that's not what they're allowed to do. They were apparently then allowed to go on their voyage, and they travelled for a number of days, about 4 days according to this police document, before being intercepted again by Australian authorities. And it was at that point when Australian authorities, according to this initial investigation by Indonesian police, told them that they were not able to continue, that their boat was not in sufficient condition, and that the conditions of the ocean would mean that they weren't able to make it to New Zealand. There was some kind of interrogation of the captain, according to this document, at that point in time, and some kind of deal struck. It's then alleged that they were taken to Australian waters and then taken to just off the coast of the Ashmore Islands, where they anchored for a couple of days. And then Australian authorities apparently provided two boats and split up the passengers and crew onto those two boats, and they were sent back towards Indonesia after this alleged exchange of money took place. The captain, Johannes Humiang, was allegedly paid $6,000, and the other five crew members were paid about $5,000 each in order to take the passengers back towards Indonesia.
And why do you think the Indonesian police are showing you all this?
It seems that they're trying to back up the allegations they've originally made, which is that these asylum seeker boat crew came ashore with wads of cash, with thousands of US dollars. That claim, which Indonesian police have made on behalf of the people that they've spoken to effectively, has been refuted by Australian authorities at one point when ministers of the Australian government denied that it initially happened. Now, as we know, since then, Australian authorities and the government, including the Prime Minister, have refused to deny that it happened. But it seems that Indonesian police are keen to show that they have some kind of evidence that shows that there was a payment made and that these events did take place on the ocean.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. There's been a rare display of public opposition to the government in Nauru. The country's parliament was suspended after a rowdy protest by supporters of several opposition MPs. The five MPs were suspended from parliament a year ago after making critical comments about the government to foreign media. The protesters say they've been left without a voice in parliament and they want their members reinstated. Liam Fox has the story.
As Nauru's parliament convened, several hundred protesters gathered outside. Lockley Danuga is one of the protesters. Like the others, he's from one of the constituencies represented by the five opposition MPs who were suspended from parliament in May last year. They were booted out after they made critical comments about the government's performance to foreign media. Mr. Danuga says the protesters are angry they've been left without representation in parliament for more than a year.
This government is going to answer to the people now because they're not listening to the MPs.
There were some minor scuffles between the protesters and police guarding parliament, and some windows were broken. Footage taken on a mobile phone shows smoke, believed to be from boating flares, rising amid the protesters. Parliament was suspended because of the commotion. Mr. Danuga says one of the suspended opposition MPs, Matthew Batsuya, was arrested when he took the protest inside Parliament House.
Just because Matthew was protesting or supporting the protest inside the house while the Parliament sitting, we heard that he's been taken into jail. Now we're waiting for him to be, we protested that he be taken out.
The ABC understands that Mr. Batsuya is now being held at a police station and his legal representative is trying to speak to him. Back at the protest, Mr. Danuga says apart from one police officer, no one from the government has come out to address the crowd.
One of the police representatives came out to speak to the crowd to find out, because Matthew Batsuya's mother was with the crowd, so is the father. They're sitting outside here now. He came out to say, find out what's going on, but apparently the mother still wants Matthew out.
Mr. Denuga says the protesters are also worried by other recent controversial moves by the government, including a ban on Facebook and a crackdown on free speech.
All of us, that's been going out in media before, banning of Facebook and everything, but most of all is because they haven't been heard in the parliament, because that's their constitutional right, that they need to be heard.
In a statement released a short time ago, the Nauru government condemned the protest, labelling it ugly and disgraceful. It says 10 police officers were injured after protesters pelted them with rocks. The statement confirms the arrest of opposition MP Matthew Batsuya on a charge of disrupting the legislature.
A Solomon Islands academic says the future of the Melanesian spearhead group hinges on how its leaders vote on West Papuan membership in its upcoming meeting. Takirias Tara Karatana, who is an associate professor at the University of Hawaii School of Pacific Island Studies, says some MSG leaders can either make a moral decision to support the indigenous people of West Papua or an economic one and choose to strengthen ties with Indonesia. He speaks next to Corey Hawkins.
The upcoming MSG meeting will be very important for two reasons. One is that it will demonstrate whether or not there is unity within the Melanesian spearhead group amongst the Melanesian countries. And the second is the role that Indonesia plays as it poses itself as an emerging Asia-Pacific power and the important role it will have not only in the Melanesian region but the Pacific Islands region as well. So for those two reasons, this MSG meeting and the issue of West Papua is important. Of course, another reason why it is important is because the people of West Papua, particularly the indigenous Melanesian people of West Papua, are placing their hope on the Melanesian spearhead group, and this will mean a lot to them on whether or not the MSG decides to admit West Papua as a member of MSG.
Now, there seems to be a lot of public support within all the MSG countries for West Papua. Why do you think that does not translate into their governments doing what seems to be quite an easy decision in terms of public support for West Papua?
That's a very good question. And I suppose one of the reasons is that some of the governments, in particular places like Fiji, for instance, in Papua New Guinea, perhaps think that the issue of West Papua does not translate into election results. And so come next election, it will not be the issue of West Papua that will be important. Or in other words, issues of international relations and foreign policy do not often feature very important in the election and the choices of who people vote. They will probably be looking at economic issues. And so for Papua New Guinea and Fiji in particular, and increasingly the case of Solomon Islands, Indonesia is a potentially important economic partner, Fiji in particular and Papua New Guinea. And whether that economic partnership translates to the provision of services on the ground, the development of infrastructure, the development of agriculture and so forth, is what will determine how people vote. And so I think that's one of the important reasons that despite the widespread support for West Papua, not only within the Pacific but outside of the Pacific, it hasn't translated into government policies.
And just examining some of the possible outcomes of this, not only could there be a possibility that West Papua doesn't get membership, but Indonesia could be admitted as a member.
Yeah, Indonesia, as you know, was admitted in 2011 as an observer on the MSG. And the Prime Minister of Fiji is now proposing that Indonesia be admitted as an associate member. What exactly an associate member means hasn't been defined. And it would be interesting to see how the leaders define an associate member. And if that happens, a lot of things are important to consider. First is that it means that West Papua will be shut out from any MSG discussion because Indonesia will have a much more important status as an associate member. And the second is that it will mean that Indonesia will have an international avenue in which to influence Pacific Island policies and things going on in the region, particularly in the Western Pacific.
And looking at the other scenario, say West Papua does get membership, what then? Surely there will be some repercussions for people living in West Papua from Indonesia.
There will be repercussions not only for people living people in West Papua, but also for the MSG countries that have cordial relationship and have military, economic, and political partnerships with Indonesia. Fiji, as you know, has signed a development agreement with Indonesia, and it would be interesting what would happen if Indonesia, if West Papua is admitted as a member of the MSG. Within West Papua, of course, there has always been human rights abuses, and there have been a lot of Indonesian government campaign against the membership of the West Papuans in MSG. And if they're admitted, it would mean that I suspect the Indonesian government would clamp down much more harshly on particularly pro-independence movements within West Papua.
And finally on the program, a Samoan half Ironman competition later this year is attracting more interest from Samoans interested in competition. Organizer Seti Afo says the Warrior Race event, which involves running, swimming, and cycling, gets a lot of interest from overseas athletes, but locals are getting more involved. He tells Bruce Hill these sort of events are getting more and more popular around the Pacific as interest in exercise, diet, and fitness grows.
1st of August is the third race of the Warrior Race, we call it. We can't call it Ironman because it's just somebody else's brand, but it's the same race, as you know. So third year this year, and success-wise, we are doing really well. Of course, you measure success in many ways, but if I measure success in terms of local participation, then I would say it's been a huge success in Samoa.
So this just isn't for people from overseas, from Australia, New Zealand, America, and Europe. A lot of Samoans are taking part in this.
Well, this is the joy, I guess, of me having living in Samoa. As an event promoter, event director, and an organizer, because after the event is gone, I don't go off to back to Australia or New Zealand, like many event promoters do in the Pacific. They run an event in Fiji, Vanuatu, or Rarotonga, and then come back to New Zealand or Australia. I live there. And so when the big event is finished, there is the local development in between.
So the people in Samoa are excited? Are local people entering the race?
It's hard work because triathlon is a new sport even to establish countries like New Zealand and Australia.
It's a hard thing. We're talking about running and swimming and cycling. I mean, just to finish that course without dying, you've got to be pretty fit.
Determined. You've got to be really determined. And so in a place like Samoa where it's really hot, and also where there is limited resources in terms of equipment, all right. So in terms of the national uptake of the sport, it's gradual, but that's what we need, a gradual uptake of the sport. So we're seeing, we're seeing villages, whole villages, now getting behind their athletes to come and support them. We have a village called Saluafata, 20 kilometres east of Apia, on the northeast coast road. That village has about 20 youngsters competing in the triathlons now.
Is this feeding into the whole push for better nutrition and fitness and getting people a bit fitter and getting them off the couch and doing something a bit physical that's happening all over the Pacific at the moment?
Well, it certainly is. In Samoa anyway, in our case, people are certainly aware of their mortality, you know, of their limitations body-wise. And there's an uptake of fitness, uptake of activity, and people are eating better. It's one of those things that people have been preaching about for the last few years, but now suddenly, all of a sudden, people are starting to realize, yes, I live better and I live longer, when I am fitter and I eat better. So yeah, definitely.
The thought of doing a triathlon, though, is pretty daunting to a lot of people. What would you recommend to someone in Samoa or anywhere in the Pacific who wants to get fit but doesn't want to, like, you know, run half a marathon and then swim a few kilometres and then do a cycle race?
The best way introduction to triathlons is to do a team event, a teams event, where you either do the bike, the run, or the swim, and be a part of a tri-team. Now, most teams that are involved in our events are teams of two, because one person actually can cover, for example, the swimmer, he can cover the run as well. Or the swimmer can bike and somebody else can run. So if you want to really give a triathlon a try, that would be a good way.
Well, I'm pretty out of shape. Do you think I should do it?
I got your name down in the starting list for the next year's race. Well, you can do it. Anybody can do it.
I rather foolishly agreed to do that, didn't I?
No, it wasn't. Because, you see, now in the last few weeks, a few months and so on, you've had a goal yourself. You've been thinking about this. And same as me. So we are thinking about these things, and they become KPIs in our own personal lives, where we know, okay, I've got to do something about myself.
And this is catching on in Samoa and around the Pacific. You think people are really making a decision, I'm going to get off the couch, I'm going to be fit, I'm not going to die of hypertensive heart disease or diabetes? Because there's a lot of that about.
There is a lot of that about, and I think we've actually now gone over the crest of the hill, if you like, in terms of education has played a huge role in the last few years, and people are now catching the message of healthy living, eating well. Local foods are best because they are growing. For example, you know, we have chicken imported into Samoa from, you know, these are chickens that would go in all of them. We have chickens right there. And locals are now discovering, actually, Samoan chickens, though they be skinny, taste better and are a lot more healthier for them. And that's the way the trend is for us now.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as past editions, by visiting our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.